Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Paul. What's up?
I'm doing good. How are you? As we come to the end of the season and the holidays, are you all set?
Yes, this is. It's just a few days before Christmas. I am actually set. Are you set?
Almost.
Yeah, which means, have you started?
You know, this is such a strange time of year, and I know you're going to talk about it a little bit, but for some, it's such a happy time. For so many others, I'm one of those tired, frustrated, can't wait till it's all over, stressed. Everything. It's somehow the happy is outweighed by all the other stuff. And I know there's a lot of people alone and other things that makes it even worse. But
do you want to start the show off any lower than that?
You can build it up from there.
Can't go any lower than that.
I'm a little negative for the holidays here.
Well,
I'm a little
okay, we're going to cheer you up today. I hope you're ready because we have a fun guest on the show today. We're about We're about to spend time with my friend Greg. Let's call him Greg W. because he and I met at a 12-step meeting that both of us regularly attend. Greg's story is especially fascinating, comedic, and tragic, but in the end, it's a story of redemption. And for that reason, I've titled the show From Headlines to Breadlines and Back Again. Greg W. was actually once, I think I could safely say, a multimillionaire, and then he discovered something even more appealing than money, and that be drugs and alcohol. Tragically, Greg's story is so common in our stressful society today, that is, folks that have lost the ability to live any kind of normal life because of the devastation caused by addiction. And the sad truth is that many, many people never find a way out, but Greg did. And that is what I want to chat about with Greg today. So, Greg, welcome to the next chapter with Charlie.
Thank you very much, Charlie. Good to talk to you today.
Nice to talk to you. So, you know what I thought we'd do? I thought we'd start off by talking in, just to get warmed up, by talking in 12-step language. And what I'm just curious about is how much time, in quotes, do you have now, which is code in 12-step programs for how long you've been sober?
So in 12-step program, we would say I have a solid 3, working on 4, and that'd be February 23rd of 2014 was my sobriety date.
Oh, so you're just a couple months away from 4 years.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, one day at a time.
One day at a time, always.
Okay, and that was after being out there, which is code, another 12-step code for how long were you drinking and using drugs?
So I had an active career for 42 years, and it was productive, every bit of it. So very solid from the first drink to the last drink.
You had a solid career of drinking?
Of 42 years.
Of 42 years?
That's right.
Serious. I'm sort of befuddled. I didn't realize that. So before your life took a turn for the worst, you're an extremely successful businessman. I mean, you were what most of us would call rich. And you and I have never talked in any detail about that. Can you give us some ideas of what your life was like before the addiction hit?
So, you know, my story is, kind of a good one. Born in California and raised by a couple of hardworking parents and they worked hard, and we kind of did without for my early years. And, my dad found some success when I was around 12 years old, at the same time as about the time I probably had my first drink.
And at 12.
I went to work in a family business, and the career literally took off. And, it was Learjets and boats and Las Vegas and all the things that go with it on a daily basis. By 30, I had my first million, and by 40, I'd lost 3.
So, yeah. So how long? So the successful life lasted until 30, 35?
So the successful life lasted into my 40s in a sense, because there was so much cash flow going on that the bottom was hard to hit. It took quite a while to reach my bottom due to due to my own enabling and then that of my family.
Right.
So as far as living the dream, I felt I lived the dream well up until, you know, a few months prior to my getting sober with my sixth DUI in 2013.
Oh, so you were happy with it all the time.
Very happy, yeah. It was just part of the lifestyle. I accepted it as a way of life and, you know, figured that's how it was.
That's what a lot of people don't understand about addiction is that we do it because we like it, because it's good. You know, we have fun doing that.
I like to think of myself as a direct product. There's a book we read in program, and there's a comment in there that says alcoholics drink primarily because they like the effects produced by alcohol. And I'm that guy. I like the effects produced by alcohol.
Yeah. Yeah, and you use the word, I'm using the word 12 steps, so the phrase 12 steps, and you use the word program. You want to explain to us how that's different?
So I'm not sure that my opinion or view, you know, everybody has opinions, as we like to say, right? I'm not sure if it's different than everybody else's, but, you know, it's certainly my own. And I try to spend a great deal of time working my own program and not somebody else's. So when we talk about program, to me, the 12 steps are in the big book that we refer to as the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and not to blow the anonymity of the program, but that is the program I work. And the 12 steps are contained within the pages of that book, and there's various iterations of whether it be the first 103 pages or the first 164 pages, but within those pages are the 12 steps that we work as a primary program, as a guide to living. And so I work the program with all the things that are suggested in the book, where it refers to things like where we meet frequently for a place for newcomers to meet and things like that. That's not necessarily in the 12 steps. It's one of the suggestions that's in the body of the book.
And, right.
So I've kind of encompassed the concept of the program versus just the 12 steps. The 12 steps are something that I took and I put into my life, and now they're part of my heart and how I try to be and behave. And the program is my guideline for it being able to implement those 12 steps. So probably the same but different. Some people look at it as a very narrow path, and I find the path is narrowed as I've gone on, but the freedom is huge. So
how is it narrowed? Tell me what you mean by narrowed.
So I'd say that's my moral compass, right, or my moral conscience. And, you know, things that were once okay just aren't today, and it's not because you told me so. It's because I tell me so.
Right.
You know, a direct result of having worked the steps and being an active member of the program has recalibrated my moral compass, and that's pretty much how I like to refer to it. And, you know, my program is based a lot on prayer, and one of my regular prayers is to God for him to continue to keep resetting that moral compass of mine and my conscience. And, you know, some people take offense to that, but it is my personal experience, and that's what I try to share with people when they ask me the question. And so that's the narrowing of the path, and it doesn't bind me. It actually gives me more freedom to be better and kinder to other people, and then I don't sit in regret and remorse. And that's kind of the fundamentals of how I stay so clean and sober today, I should say.
Yeah, because you don't want to go into that, you know, what we call it, incomprehensible demoralization.
Correct.
And I like the idea of the moral compass. I think the program, as you call it, really does help set a moral compass. In fact, the program, you know, we've said over and over, it's not just for people with addictions and recovery problems. It really is something that everybody in the world could use. I mean, there's only alcohol is mentioned one time. Other than that, it's all about life and how you live life and how you approach life and approach other people.
I couldn't put it better. I couldn't put it better. I fully agree.
So tell me, you know, before we get into the drinking and drugging, I really want to know a little bit more because I am really curious because I've never been a rich guy, and I'm curious, what was it like to be a rich guy? And I know you say that's comparatively speaking what's rich, but for most of us,
right,
you were rich.
You know, so you read my mind on that one. So I think rich is relevant, right? And it's relative to who you are and what's going on in your life and how you were raised. So, you know, as it creeped up on me, you know, I worked. I truly worked at it. It wasn't a gift. I didn't win the lottery, and I wasn't a trust fund baby. So I worked through the, you know, I worked through the family business and came up doing all those things that we do. But you know, being a product of the 70s, you know, I graduated high school in 1978. A dollar went a lot further. So when we went out and made $100 a day, you were a big shot already. At you know, at 16, 17 years old in 1975 or six.
Right.
So you know, from that point, you know, things started rolling in, and you know, $5,000 and $10,000 checks, and I built sailboats and did some things like that. So it seemed to me like I had the Midas touch. The problem is there was some criminal activity probably involved in that as we go along, and I'm probably not going to admit to my felonies here on your radio show today. But you know, I am here to be candid and honest with you, and I won't tell you there weren't any. And, you know, so we could go down the path of incarceration and those type of things as well, which has all been a direct result of my drugs and alcohol use. You know, I suffered all the consequences and I suffered some of the benefits. But somewhere along the line, I got a line where I was making a successful, honest, legitimate dollar. And I will say this as simply as I can, rich doesn't suck. You know, you know, it just does not. And if you're going to have problems, I'd rather have them with a pocket full of money than not.
Yeah, I've been rich and I've been poor, and rich is better.
That's right. And, you know, but with that comes great entitlement and a great sense of self-importance. And,
right.
You know, the books that we read in our program that we talk about, Charlie, you know, it talks about our ego and our pride and things along those lines.
Right.
And, you know, I suffered from those being supersized, as I like to call it. You know, I was larger than life, certainly in my own head. So, you know, I mean, I really lived the dream. I mean, you know, when somebody say, how you doing today? I go, I'm living the dream. And I meant it. There wasn't anything I wanted for the longest time. You know, paychecks were literally rolling in, you know, to the tune of $30,000 and $40,000 a week for a few years there. And I was spending, you know, just to give you an idea on the type of addiction habit I had, you know, I was spending between $500 and $1,000 a day for almost 10 years.
No kidding.
I did support myself and that wife's habit at that time. So I took a sweet young lady. I married her. Marriage is also part of my story. I've done it multiple times. And I led her down to a path of ruin as well. And, of course, people would like to say that, you know, she left me. You know, I pushed that woman away. And that's how I look at it today. So,
yeah, so you're taking responsibility for that.
I take responsibility today. That's a gift of this program.
Yeah. So tell me, how did, if all of this is rolling along fine and smooth, how did the drinking and drugging begin?
So, you know, I guess I'll use some cliche things. We talk about, you know, being a liar, cheat, and a thief, and I didn't think I was any of them. But when I look back at the truth of the matter, you know, I stole my first drink, you know, snuck into my father's liquor cabinet and stole a bottle of rum, right? And snuck out with some guys and drank that, and that's how it started. That and, you know, one of the older guys, I ran around with some older guys, and they had that influence on me, and they had that certain power and lure, and I wanted to be like them. So, you know, I like to call it peer pressure. I didn't have a bad life, so I wasn't reaching out or running from anything, and to this day, you know, our steps are supposed to help us uncover that. I have not been able to find out the real cause and condition other than the fact that I commented earlier that I like being loaded. Right? And it seemed like a really, really cool thing. And, you know, from there it was pretty innocent, you know, for all those years of high school. But, you know, the trouble started. Shortly after that first drink and drug, I found myself on probation as a juvenile. And then I found myself with an 18-day stint in juvenile hall here in Orange County. And all the money, and at that point my family had become, you know, relatively successful. And all the money and all the lawyers and all the attorneys couldn't get me out of juvenile hall for 18 days for the things I had done. And, you know, I've spent a better part of my life on probation, whether being a juvenile or an adult.
And this is even what, this is even during the time that you were successful.
Yes. During the time there was a run there. There was a period there where there was no trouble. And, you know, there again is the gift of the fortune, right? If trouble came, you know, there were high-priced attorneys, and there were ways out of things, right? So I would probably say between 21 and 38 years old, I went without a run-in with the law.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's something. If you're and were you still not were you drinking heavily and doing your stuff heavily then or
so I was. I'm not sure what kind of detail you'd like to hear me go into, but
we love stories.
I went into a very daily daily routine maintenance program of crack cocaine. Daily maintenance. It's what I did on a daily basis. If I was awake, I was high. And that probably started at around 27 and went until I was about 41.
And then what happened at 41?
The wheels just fell off. A lot of things had happened in between. My father had passed in 99 and a couple of years. So I'd started running our family business prior to that. And a few years after that, after he passed, my habit kicked back into high gear again. I had been able to keep it at bay to probably somewhere around an ounce a day. And
an ounce? Wait a minute.
About an ounce a day.
You kept it down to an ounce a day?
I kept it down to an ounce a day.
That's like a real lot, isn't it?
So I've been through my third divorce at this point. And so that's when I said I kept it down. It's because I was only supporting my habit. I found myself alone at this point, you know, in my 40s. And at that point, I ruined the family business and things really took off.
Oh, so the whole business got ruined.
So, and I didn't lose my business or my fortune or my wealth or my homes or anything because I wasn't capable. I lost them because I quit working and I became incapable, right? The drugs and the alcohol just were all powerful, right? They took over everything and it became my sole focus. And, I couldn't spend enough time chasing it down in the alleys of Santa Ana and doing those type of things, so. Those, if your listeners are from the Orange County area, they know where I'm talking.
People remember you. Yeah.
I pull up in a red Ferrari and throw $100 bills out to the crack guys. You know, so my life was bitching. I mean, let's just call it what it is. It was awesome.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
You pull up to some no count bar in Tustin. In a Ferrari, and you're throwing out $100 bills to guys need cocaine.
So it would be worse than that. It would be 3 o'clock in the morning driving through the downtown streets in the alleys of Santa Ana and buying $20 and $40 worth of crack cocaine. I was a purist, so I had quit snorting coke at this point. I did not do methamphetamine or heroin or anything else. I smoked crack cocaine. That was what I did.
Oh, that's a purist? Is that what a purist does?
I was a purist. I didn't screw around with anything else.
Oh, so you didn't snort it or anything. It was all smoking it.
So it started with that first line, around 18 in high school. You know, a buddy of mine, I remember him well, down at his apartment. He had a quarter gram and a line was done. And, and that's when it started. But it didn't really consume me completely until my later 20s. And it was by, sheer luck and, doing evil things that allowed me to keep operating all through my 30s. Lying, cheating, stealing, scandalous behavior, all the things that go with drug addiction and alcoholism, but on a higher scale because I was entitled. I felt very entitled and I had the deep pockets at that point. I mean, it was, I maintained 7 figures up until, in my bank account up until my late 30s.
Yeah, I could see why it was fun because you're a very gregarious and likable guy that you were probably, you were probably the life of the party at the pubs.
I'd like to think so, right? often I think those poor people, I still wonder today how the bars survive without me, so.
So, Greg, tell me what was it that made you realize, or when did you realize that you had a problem?
So, my first trip to one of the local rehabs at one of our well-known hospitals here in Orange.
Your first trip?
My first trip. My first of 11. I've been to 11 rehabs.
Wait a minute. Let's stop there. You've been to 11 rehabs?
11.
And what was the average stay at these places?
So my first stay was 3 days, and on the third day I had called my dad. And my dad was a hard charging guy. He's from Oklahoma, right? And didn't understand the concept of a drug addiction and whatnot, and said, you know, that I could man up and lick this. So on the third day, I gave him a call, and he came and picked me up and took me to the bar, and we had a drink and talked about it. And I had never gone to rehab for alcohol. I went for drugs each and every time, in either for by voluntary or by court order. So, and the only voluntary visits were the first one. You know, all subsequent ones were either by suggestion of a wife and or the judge.
And those were typically, were those the 30-day system?
Each one got longer. So the first one was 3 days. The second time I went back to the same program and managed to graduate their 28-day program. And upon graduating that 28-day program, I took a bunch of people from the CA meeting that we went to a little-known restaurant that's now since out of business, so I can probably say their name, a little place in Tustin called Newport 17. And I sat down with all these folks, and I ordered a vodka tonic. And they looked at me like, what the hell about abstinence? Don't you understand? And I said, I'm not here for alcohol. I'm here for drugs. And those people ceased to communicate with me any longer after that day. And here I thought I had mastered a sobriety at that point. And that would have been...
Oh, you were at the rehab for drugs, and so you felt like you could drink okay, that drinking wasn't a problem for you.
Yes. All 11 times.
Tell us the relationship, because I don't think everybody really realizes the relationship between alcohol and drugs. Because we now find, I think somebody one time in one of the meetings took a poll, and, you know, there may have been 50 people in the room, and how many people in this room have a problem with drinking only and have never had drugs? And, you know, what was it, one or two people raised their hand that they only drank, that they didn't use drugs?
So I guess that would be the pure alcoholic, if you will, right? We don't know too many of those these days.
No, those are the old, what we call the old-timers.
The old-timers,
the people
right.
with 20 and 30 and 40 years.
Right. We see some guys like that with 40, 45 years, and alcohol is the only part of their story. For the most part, I'd say, you know, we talk about our program being always inclusive, never exclusive, and it needs to be that way today because of... the cross addictions, if you will, I guess. You know, I'm certainly no expert. I think there's a difference, having been both a hardcore drug addict as well as a hardcore alcoholic. The last 15 years, I did not touch any drugs before I showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous. I got clean around 2002, and you know, haven't picked up anything, any narcotics or drugs since that time. But all those years subsequent, you know, with pure alcohol, so I've experienced both. So I think there's a difference. But our behaviors probably aren't a lot different. Putting down one and staying clean and putting down the drink and staying sober is a little bit different with the temptations and things that are in life.
Well, with you with cocaine, was cocaine easier to quit than alcohol?
It was harder to quit. It was easier to stay quit from.
Oh.
It lurked and lured in my head for a long, long time, whereas the alcohol... you know, it was hard to change the lifestyle from it because things have progressed. So, you know, there's a lot of similarities, and it suggested that we look for the similarities when we hear somebody's story, like, well, that didn't happen to me, but that did. And
right.
So I try to listen for that more than I listen for what didn't happen to somebody, because those are all my yets that we talk about a lot in our program. You know, our yets are the things that haven't happened to us yet, right? And yet stands for you're eligible too. And just because I haven't put a needle in my arm yet doesn't mean I'm not eligible to do so if I continue going down the path that I did.
That's the I think that's one of the big words that's used in, and I like your use of the word program over 12 steps, but if I use that word, most of our listeners won't understand what program means, but they do catch 12 steps.
Right.
But I was... Now, after I explained that, I forgot what my question was going to be or my comment.
Well, so we're talking a little bit about the differences, I guess, between the two.
Paul wants to know, Paul, do you think that's good? My producer
just,
wants
just
to know
quickly,
the 12.
Just quickly, yeah. You know, everybody says 12-step program, and for those who've never been through one, what are they? I know the first couple. One is admit you have a problem, which is the hardest part, I guess.
So I broke the 12 steps down, and I didn't do it. I heard it from somebody else. In fact, probably everything I say about program or 12-step related is something I heard somebody else say that I passed along, that I found a solution. But it was
right
down to me of trust God, clean house, and help others. And that's our first three steps is admit, believe, and decide. or I can't, he can, and let him, for those that are of the religious nature, right? Or the looking for the spiritual path down, you know, for God. And then our fourth and through ninth step are about cleaning house, and that's a moral inventory and things along that line. And then our last three steps, 10, 11, and 12, are about helping others, being of service, which is, of course, you know, a good foundation and root, you know, root cause to have for everybody that wants to get better. You know,
yeah.
If you can find that getting out of our head. So, I mean, that's, the steps are for us to believe in something greater than ourselves, and then take a moral inventory of the things that we've done wrong and who have wronged us, and then to try to forgive those people while we're working aggressively at forgiving ourselves for the terrible mistakes that we've made, and not really identifying somebody else's part in it, but identifying our own part.
Yeah, making amends, but it's, you know, that self-reflection of taking a moral inventory. If you have a good sponsor, which is somebody who walks with you, it's a friend. I like the way somebody said it in a meeting a couple nights ago. They don't walk in front of you or behind you. They walk alongside of you. And it's a friend that's just walking the process with you at the same time. But that working with a sponsor gets you where you're admitting to that person your moral defects, and they're helping you understand who do you need to make amends to. It's a very self-reflective time to get an idea of who you are and where you're headed. I want to talk a little bit more. I want to switch gears.
Sure.
And I want to talk a little bit about, not a little bit, I want to talk a lot about recovery. But before we do that, Greg, we need to take a break. So let's just take a brief break and we'll come back.
Okay.
Hi there, this is Charlie Hedges, and you're listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie. My very special guest today is my friend Greg W., who is a partner in sobriety with me at a 12-step group. And we are talking about what it means to go from, Greg was extremely successful, and we're talking about what it means to go from headlines, and he didn't quite go to breadlines, but he certainly went to the bottom of the barrel. And then the cool thing about Greg is that he has made it back again. But I think what's important, Greg, don't you, that back again is one day at a time. And we always know that we are addicts and that we are capable of, in 12-step terms, of going out, you know, taking a drink or doing a drug at any time, that we are fully capable of that.
I couldn't agree more.
Okay, so you went to, did you say 12 rehabs?
11.
11, oh, I'm sorry. You know,
I'm sorry, yes.
So are the people who are taking your money.
Right. That's so far, Charlie.
So far, the yet.
That's so far.
Why didn't, okay, with 11 attempts and 11 recovery rehabs, why didn't those work? What's the story around that?
So my key problem centers around the reason I ended up where I ended up was a lack of gratitude, and the reasons and that's just long story short. I was never grateful for anything I did. I thought I did everything myself, and I thought I was all powerful. Right? I even though I had faith and all that type of thing. So that probably led me not to be out of appreciation for things. The reason the rehabs never caught on or took on is I never had any willingness to totally give myself over. And that would be the idea of surrender or that type of thing. And I wasn't willing to admit, and it says things in our books and our program, about I was never willing to concede to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. And I suffer from, and again, it's stated by somebody else, that the great obsession of every abnormal drinker is to think that he can once again drink like a normal person. I'm that guy. I continually thought I got this now, you know, and it did its thing. And I was never willing to uh, to give in to the simple rules that are suggested in the program.
I know I've worked with people as I see it, and you know, I work with people who have just said they have gone out and they said, and those were the words that they used, Greg, was, I got this thing. You know, yeah. I got this thing. I know I can be a normal drinker, and half of them don't make it past the first night. Because after you had, because you know the statement that it's trite. Well, it's especially trite in our groups, but it is so true that one drink is too many and 20 isn't enough.
That's right, right. so true. I heard that more in the narcotics type of people, but I find that applies perfectly well for alcoholism.
Oh, you know the worst thing. What is the worst thing that we see when we're around people who are drinking? Is that they walk away with a half a glass of wine still sitting on the table.
That's always troubling. Still, to this
I mean,
day.
Yeah, to this day it is to me too. It's like, wait a minute, what are you doing? You still got wine there.
They'll be out with a normie, and they'll be drinking, and they'll say, let's go. And I'm like, well, I'll wait for you to finish your drink. And they're like, I'm good. And I'm like, you can't be. So it's an amazing phenomena, no doubt.
That really is. So I want to go in deeper, Greg.
Sure.
Because you sort of slip into addiction. It's not like, you know, you wake up one day and you're addicted. You know, there's a slipping, a sliding into it, and before you know it, it's all on you. But recovery, you don't slip into it. You may have a lot of relapses, but there's some point where it is I'm done. It's like an overnight experience almost, to where I am done, and I know that I'm still vulnerable, but I know right now my obsession and my needing of some kind of substance is not as strong as it was. What do you think was the, let me go ahead and use a stupid word, secret. What was your secret that made you think, I'm done, I am not going to do this anymore?
That would have been the things that I learned on my very first rehab. The things I learned on my very first visit to rehab, I learned then, and that's when they talk about the mustard seed was planted, right? That mustard seed of hope.
Yes.
That I knew that there was a solution, and that would be found in program, and I wasn't willing, yet again, back to that word, I wasn't willing to accept any of it because I didn't want to change and become who I am, who I've become today. And that stems around the fears that I had, right? Because I found my identity in drugs and alcohol. There's where I find a huge difference between the addiction and the alcoholism. For me, was I'd ruined everything and lost everything in my act of addiction, which was always with a glass of vodka. Don't get me wrong. It wasn't, you know, I drank the whole time. It started and ended with alcohol. But I ruined everything during the addiction period of the straight addiction. When I talk about that, I talk about the crack cocaine. That's when I ruined and lost everything. I managed to stay at my bottom for almost 15 years, content with that bottom, because it was easily maintainable, right? It was acceptable to society to sit in a bar with a bunch of old guys, 20, 30 years my senior, and tell war stories. And if I didn't have one, I'd make it up, because, you know, I'm a liar, cheat, and a thief.
And a good storyteller,
yeah. And the way I lived, I didn't have to make much up, because I lived a pretty flamboyant lifestyle, right? I mean, you know, most people aren't going to Las Vegas one day and Cabo San Lucas the next on their own jet, right?
No, that's not what most of us get to do.
No, not most.
No. You know, you use a word, willingness, and I think that sometimes that's almost an unaccepted word in the 12-step circles, in which I disagree with, because I really feel like you really, I don't want to say begins, who knows what it begins with, but willingness is a critical part of the steps. If you're not willing, if you don't want to get sober and you're not willing to go through the effort of getting sober, you're not going to get sober.
I agree.
And I don't care how many times you pray, how many times you go through the steps, and how many sponsors you had, if you don't have a genuine desire to get sober and to break an addiction, it's just not going to happen.
most of us have to come in pretty beat up and mangled, though, to find that willingness to have the, and, you know, people use the comment of the gift of desperation. And I didn't have that. I was just done. I think I've, you know, Charlie, that I showed up at a meeting where I met you with an ankle bracelet on that I wore for a year. I was beat into willingness, if you will. I was on house arrest for my sixth DUI.
For your sixth DUI?
For my sixth DUI.
And you didn't have to do time behind that?
I did not. Not behind the sixth one. I did the fourth and fifth.
Oh, did you really?
I did the fourth and
so
fifth.
So you've done jail time as well?
I have done several in our Orange County jail system. Yes, I've managed to put together some significant time, almost as much time in the jail system as I have sober today.
No way.
Combined, collective, yes. You know, 90 days here, 6 months here, sure, that's how the judges treat you.
Holy cow.
Yes, sir.
You know, and you live such an amazing life now. What do you think, you know, because I'm always really curious of this, because our numbers, our recovery numbers are really low, and you hear any kind of number from 3% to 15% to 20%, whatever. I don't know what the number is because I read so many different numbers, but I know one thing: they're not on the winning side. It is difficult to recover. What we talk about hitting bottom, but what is it? Do you think? What does it take to get that kind of willingness? What does it? Is it just so individual that it's difficult to explain? I mean, I know what it took for me, but that would be me individually. And my producer is telling me to explain. He likes stories. I was, oh hell, we're talking. You're talking candor. I've never talked about this to my audience, but at 60 years old, I had 12 years, I was sober, and I went out for 2 years. I wasn't in a program or anything. I just quit drinking. And I quit drinking for 12 years, and then I got in with wrong playmates and wrong playground. And, you know, we talk about that all the time. If you want to stay sober, you got to change playgrounds and change playmates. And I was with the wrong group, and I started drinking again. And at 60 or 61, I was arrested for two DUIs in 2 weeks. And that was that incomprehensible demoralization. And for me, I went through about 8 months of just totally demoralized, thinking of myself I'm thinking at 60 years old, you ought to have a little wisdom and you ought to know a little bit better than that.
Right.
You know, you ought to know a little bit better than drinking and driving and getting arrested two times and having to admit to your wife and to your 20-year-old son what's happening in your life. And it's just completely humiliating and demoralizing. And that was my... You know, that was the trigger that put me over into total willingness. Say, I don't want to do that again. You know, that is just the consequences. So I'm kind of a consequence saved alcoholic. I don't want to go through that again, and I don't want to go to jail, especially since, gosh, I'm going to let so much stuff out in this week. Especially, I always laugh at the meetings and say, especially if you got a butterfly tattoo on your ass, you don't want to be in jail.
There you go. Yeah, that's what they'd call a target-rich environment. Right?
So
you bring up three things that trigger a couple things I'll touch on, if I could. One, the two DUIs in that short period of time. I'm a crime guy, right? I'd got arrested. I'd get bailed out. I'd get arrested again before that case had gone in front of the judge. And then I would do it yet again. And, you know, the judges throw the book at you pretty hard. And that's why I got the time that I got on multiple occasions, because I'd get on these very strong runs. You talk about change, playgrounds, and playmates. I've heard it be told, show me your friends and I'll show you who you are. And I became a product of that development, of that environment, right? You know, you looked around where I was hanging out and who I was with, and I fit right in, right? And that's where program has been a blessing to a guy like me, because I can show up and I can fit right in again. And
yeah.
If I want to be a chameleon, I can be a chameleon, or I can try to stand out above the rest of the crowd. And that's a direct result of trying to find some humility, right, and going down this path. So.
And that's the beauty. And that's the beauty of program and going to meetings. You know, I'm a strong believer in meetings. I have this. I often say love hate relationship with meetings. It's so many times I go to meetings and say, that sucked. I am just. That's my last meeting. I'll go home and tell my wife that's my last meeting. I'm never going again. And the next night I'm in my car. I say I think my car is a sobriety car, because at 4:30 in the afternoon it starts
that's
up
right.
And it says, we're going off to a meeting.
You find friendships and fellowships, right? And they talk about things along the lines of a host of people will grow up about you. And look at my opportunity today. I'm on a radio show talking with a friend that had I not shown up, I would have missed this. So, and that's a direct gift of my program.
Yeah, and you know the beauty, too, is that it is often stated we don't shoot our wounded. And really, for the most part, that is true. Everybody, it takes one to know one. It really takes an alcoholic to understand an alcoholic. Well, why don't you just quit? You know, just don't do it anymore. Unless you're an alcoholic, you don't understand that you just don't quit. But the beauty of meetings is you're sitting around a bunch of people that get it. And so you could say a bunch of stupid crap, stuff that sounds that normies would just go ballistic over.
That's right.
And we're all dying laughing.
That's
we're
right.
thinking it's because we all identify. We all know, you know, we're with a crew of people that are one of us, or we're one of them.
We may not shoot our wounded, but sometimes we'd like to beat them around the head a little bit, you know. Sometimes some of us that don't get it the first, fifth, or tenth time, we ache for them. We ache for them, and it's
yes.
a different kind of empathy that we develop when we do this program.
Yeah, I'm always
12 steps.
I'm just always so impressed with the people that come back. The people that have, you know, we have friends that have had 15 years and 20 years and started drinking again, and they go through their little run, and the next thing you know is they're back again. They're back at meetings and saying, I can't do this. And I think that's, you talk about humility and a willingness, they really show it. They, you know,
correct.
I am always very impressed by those people who have been through that. I have a question for you that we're going to wrap up our time here. And my question is this. I would like you to compare your life as a rich drunk to one as an average sober guy. Now, I know one thing you're going to tell me is that you're going to miss the toys. But apart from the toys, what is your life like now as just a regular guy, not the guy with the Learjets, as compared to that time when you had all the stuff, all the toys?
Well, I would probably have to say that one of the best gifts that from being sober today versus the way I lived before was the compassion for other people. And I mean, it sounds trite and sounds cliched, but to not be a hurtful individual, to not be creating the wreckage of all the, you know, I've been married 6 times. And, you know,
you've been married 6 times? I didn't know that.
Yeah, four of them were in Las Vegas on one night stand type deals, gals I met at the crap table. But still, 6 times. And each time the next morning, I was breaking somebody's heart when I told them they weren't coming back to California with me. So. You know, there's a tremendous amount of hurt and pain that goes with that, and I don't cause that anymore today. You know, the thing you mentioned about the toys, I'd be lying to you if I told you I didn't miss the stuff, right? The gift of the life that I have today, I make a reasonable income, I have the opportunity to improve myself, and if I want those things back, I've been able to recognize and appreciate the value of work. You know, I get into everything that I put into life today. I get back exactly proportionate to what I put into it. And that's my work, that's my recovery, and that's my relationships. And my whole life today is about my relationship with whatever it is, whether it be with drugs, alcohol, you, my employer, my mom, my family, my girlfriend. Everything today I break down into a relationship, and how can I make that relationship better, and where can I participate? And when I give, I get. And it's that simple.
Boy, you know, you really do, and you do such a great job at that. I mean, that's why I wanted to have you on the show, because...
You flatter me.
Well, it's truthful. It's because you are relationship. I'm glad you said that, because I don't know I would have used that word, but that is so true of you, that you... You truly love on people, and you care about people, and there's a softness in your heart that we all get, that we know that you care about us.
Thank you.
That's really great. Well, listen, Greg, I want to thank you so much for spending time with me today. It's been an honor, and I appreciate your candor, and letting us know what it's like. I think this is going to help so many people.
I hope so.
And I also want to thank all our listeners for tuning in to The Next Chapter with Charlie. Also, be sure to check us out at thenextchapter.life. That's right. It's thenextchapter.life, L-I-F-E. This is Charlie Hedges signing off. Until next, bye for now.
You've been listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie, right here in Orange County's only community radio station, OCTalkRadio.net.